It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up from the Singapore skyline to the stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, our guest talks about a new photography exhibit out to highlight extremes of wealth and poverty in the world. But first, Wisconsin is only a few weeks away from the state's 2016 presidential primary, and it's shaping up to be a battleground state for the candidates. Bernie Sanders needs to catch up to Democratic contender Hillary Clinton if he wants to secure the party's nomination. And Republican frontrunner Donald Trump is polling low in some key conservative parts of Wisconsin. Joining us now to talk Wisconsin politics is Craig Gilbert. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he writes the Wisconsin Voter blog. Craig, welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
Well, let's start out here with Donald Trump. And you recently wrote that he's out of favor among some Wisconsin Republicans in specific regions of the state. Why is that?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, the places where he's weakest are really the most important Republican counties in the state, the counties in southeastern Wisconsin, these key Republican counties like Waukesha, Washington, and Ozaukee, which typically, along with their neighboring counties, kind of dictate the outcomes of Republican primaries because of the size of their population. Their turnout rates are off the charts. If you look at the history of Republican primaries, the winner often loses large other parts of the state but wins big, like Scott Walker did in his 2010 Republican primary for governor. That vote tends to carry the day, but I think for a variety of reasons, Donald Trump has high negatives there. I think if you look demographically at that part of the state, the higher income and education levels, that's tended to be the pattern where Donald Trump has done better with non-college Republicans and Republicans who don't make as much money. He tends to do better in areas that have been harder hit economically, and all those things sort of describe parts of northern Wisconsin much better than they describe these areas in southeastern Wisconsin. And also, there are political factors. I mean, talk radio is a big influence in Republican politics in southeastern Wisconsin, and talk radio has largely been aligned against Donald Trump in this race, partly because he's not he is a candidate who's broken with conservatism on some big issues.
So who would come out on top in the conservative radio scene in Milwaukee?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Ted Cruz sort of appears to be the candidate of choice that's for some conservatives in that part of the state. He's not necessarily the perfect fit. I mean, Ted Cruz has tended to be the candidate who's done his best with evangelical conservatives, and that's not necessarily the driving force in southeastern Wisconsin. But we're down to three Republicans. It's Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and John Kasich, and I think for some of these conservative Republicans, John Kasich may be perceived as being a little bit too moderate, and people are also facing just the kind of strategic calculus of, if they want to beat Donald Trump, what's the best way to do it? And their nightmare is kind of seeing Ted Cruz and John Kasich split up the vote in a way that allows Donald Trump to squeak through and win the Wisconsin primary, and which gives him not only a big psychological boost, but a better shot to be on track toward winning a majority of delegates before the convention.
Okay, well, looking again specifically at this conservative region in southeastern Wisconsin, these conservative suburbs, counties around Milwaukee, how important have they been in the past to conservative candidates?
Well, just to give you some examples, I mentioned Scott Walker's victory in the 2010 primary for governor against Mark Newman, which led to his election as governor in 2010. He lost most of the state, but he won southeastern Wisconsin by huge margins, and because of the number of voters, the size of the vote that was coming out of there and how lopsided it was, he kind of breezed to victory. If you look at the last two Republican presidential primaries in Wisconsin, John McCain was the winner in southeastern Wisconsin and the winner statewide over Mike Huckabee, and Mitt Romney, the same thing, the winner over Rick Santorum, and in both cases, the loser, Santorum and Huckabee, did really well in the northern and western parts of the state and won a lot of counties up there, but they lost decisively in southeastern Wisconsin, and they couldn't overcome that.
So you're saying this could be kind of a format breaker if Trump comes in and wins despite that kind of setup,
yeah,
being weak in that area?
A big if. I mean, some people don't think you can win a primary that way in Wisconsin. I mean, it would take I think big turnout for Donald Trump in other parts of the state and big margins in other parts of the state, and it would probably also take these other two candidates, Kasich and Cruz, to kind of neutralize each other in the southern part of the state. So, you know, there's some really intriguing scenarios here. The turnout is a wild card. The open primary is kind of a wild card. We're going to have 2 weeks leading up to this Republican primary where Wisconsin is really the only action nationwide. And so you could have an actual mini campaign here, which can sometimes produce unpredictable effects.
We're talking with Craig Gilbert right now from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking Wisconsin politics. And Craig, moving on to the Democratic candidates, how is Bernie Sanders looking in Wisconsin?
Well, Wisconsin's a fairly friendly state for Bernie Sanders in comparison to a lot of these states that voted in March. A lot of those states were southern states with large African-American populations, and that really played to Hillary Clinton's strength. She's been dominant with black voters and to a lesser extent with Latino voters. And so Wisconsin's a very white state, which is generically good for Bernie Sanders. It's also a state that has an open primary, and Bernie Sanders has done significantly better with independent voters than with self-described Democrats, so that's also good for Bernie Sanders. And if you just sort of look at the history and the kind of personality of the Democratic electorate in Wisconsin, you know, it sort of feels like it ought to be receptive to Bernie Sanders just because of his politics. So he is the more liberal candidate. He's kind of a more aspirational candidate. Hillary Clinton lost Wisconsin in 2008 by 17 points to Barack Obama. So there's a lot of reasons to think Bernie Sanders has an excellent chance of winning Wisconsin. It doesn't mean he will win Wisconsin. It doesn't mean that Hillary Clinton doesn't have a shot. I mean, the last two polls that we had in January and February by Marquette Law School, it was basically a toss-up. But I think the Hillary Clinton campaign is trying to kind of lower expectations about her performance. The Sanders campaign is pretty bullish about Wisconsin, and they're in kind of a desperate struggle because she has a very imposing delegate lead, and the math is bad for him. He's really fighting not just to win primaries, but he's fighting to kind of stay relevant and convince people that this is, he's got the money to go on, but he has to, I think, also convince voters that the race is still open-ended and that he can, you know, he can not only win states, but that those victories will be meaningful.
Well, line it up for us, Craig. What needs to happen for Wisconsin, not just to matter, but to really matter come April 5th?
Well, I would say, and I think most people would say, that the drama is greater on the Republican side because you not only, like Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump has a big delegate lead, but there is a sizable anti-Trump vote, and Donald Trump is kind of in a race also against himself to get to a delegate majority and avoid a contested convention in Cleveland in July at the Republican convention. So because that means that every delegate counts, and in a state like Wisconsin, it not only matters who wins statewide because some of the delegates go to the statewide winner, but it matters who wins in every congressional district. Each congressional district will determine the allocation of three delegates, 24 in all, because there are eight House seats. So everything matters on the margins, and also I think psychologically we're reaching a moment where it's kind of do or die for the Stop Trump movement in the party, and I think Wisconsin they see as a big opportunity because Donald Trump's polling numbers have been soft here. If they fall short in Wisconsin, I think, you know, it would be a critical moment in the campaign where Republicans, I think, would begin some Republicans will want to close down the race and rally behind Donald Trump.
And Craig, just a couple of seconds left. Do you think Scott Walker is going to endorse before then?
He's been very coy, and he's talked about that a lot today, that he's not going to endorse until next week, that he's trying to figure out if his endorsement can have an impact, and if so, you know, whether it would be endorsing Cruz or Kasich. I think the betting is that if he does make an endorsement, it's more likely to be on behalf of Ted Cruz than John Kasich, but he said that he feels more aligned with both of those candidates than he does with Donald Trump.
Craig, thanks a lot.
Nice to be with you.
Craig Gilbert is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and writes the Wisconsin Voter blog. He joined us to talk about presidential politics in Wisconsin. Coming up, we take a look at income inequality through a curated collection of photographs showing global extremes in wealth and poverty. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, their numbers were down for years in southern Wisconsin, but now we'll find out why bobcat sightings are going up in parts of the state. First, income inequality is growing in the United States and around the world. We see images of extreme wealth on TV and in magazines, but our next guest thinks that what we know about income inequality is really only the tip of the iceberg. Miles Little set out to document extreme wealth and extreme poverty in the world with photographs. And the result is a photography exhibition and a book called 1%. And by the way, you can see photographs from the 1% Project on the Central Time webpage and on Facebook. Miles Little joins us now. He's a senior editor at Time Magazine and the curator of the 1% Project. Miles, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what were you looking to document with your new book and exhibit, the 1% Project?
I wanted to show wealth all around the world present day, but in maybe a more nuanced or complete way than you would typically see in, the movies or in caricature. I wanted to show not only opulence, but also education and work and leisure and family, religion, and additionally talk a little bit about sort of the hollowing out of the middle class and the working class as well.
And in the foreword to your book, you write that we think we understand wealth, as you said, through TV, through tabloids, but that we're really only seeing a drop in the bucket. What did you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you ask a typical person on the street, you know, give me an example of a really rich person. A lot of people might, you know, say an athlete, because in America, athletes are paid really high. So I did a little research and found out that in 2014, the highest paid athlete in the world was the boxer Floyd Mayweather, And he made, pardon me if I'm getting the number wrong, but $105 million, which is a lot of money. But I compared that to the highest paid hedge fund manager in the world, a guy who is, for all intents and purposes, unknown to the average man or woman on the street, a guy named Kenneth Griffin, who made $1.3 billion in 1 year. So we don't have a great sense of how rich the rich are.
Right. There's a statistic in your book that actually even surprised a few of us here in the media at Wisconsin Public Radio. And I guess someone had asked average people on the street what they thought the pay-to-pay ratio was between the top-tier CEOs in the world and ordinary people. And most people said, I think, something like 30 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
And the real answer was 350 to 1.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing, right? So I make one, and he or she up there makes 350.
Yeah. Things like that are interesting to document. So how did you go about getting that on film so that people could actually see what we're talking about and not just hear numbers like that?
So I did a lot of, I just sort of dove down that rabbit hole of online photo research, you know, going to websites of photographers I respect, maybe going to a photo agency like Magnum, which has a great online digital archive. Also doing text research, reading books, reading articles to make sure that what I'm searching for is relevant. Again, I didn't want this to be nothing but photos of fancy cars or big houses. I wanted to really try to enter the world of modern-day finance, for instance, or peer into the lives of Russia's elite, for example. There's a great project by Anna Skladman, Portraits of the Children of the Wealthy of Russia, which happens to be actually the number one most unequal developed country in the world. I read a statistic that said something like 110 billionaires control maybe about a third of all wealth in the country. Occasionally, there would be a photographer I would discover for this project through a coworker. I am a photo editor at Time Magazine, where I commission covers and features, although this project is very much a personal, independent project. And so, you know, in the day-to-day of my job, I'll hear about a great new photographer from a coworker, for instance. But the majority of the photos were found simply alone doing that web research.
Well, when we see TV shows about super wealthy people, or maybe we see the insides of their homes in magazines, it's hard, I think, for anybody not to sort of just admire that and to want that for yourself.
Yeah.
And is
yeah.
that why that you decided to include people who are living in poverty at the other end of the spectrum alongside the super wealthy?
Yeah, great point. There is an undeniable allure to wealth, and I think the sort of beautiful craftsmanship that I hope you see in the photos sort of hints at that. You know, we're seeing beautiful infinity pool on the top of a hotel in Singapore. That's the image on the cover. We're seeing gorgeous, opulent opera houses and things like that. It is undeniably attractive. But it was absolutely important to balance that out by talking about pressures on the American middle class. For example, you know, the decline of the manufacturing base that once sort of created the American middle class, that is hinted at in the book. We're also seeing a little trace here or there of the poor. There's an amazing picture from South Africa by Michael Sabotsky of people who are rummaging around in a rubbish dump for, trying to get food or new belongings. And I think a little bit of darkness amidst all of this beauty and allure, I think, makes a very powerful statement. A little bit of darkness offset by a lot of lightness almost seems that much more dark.
We're talking with Miles Little right now. He's a senior photo editor at Time Magazine and the curator of the 1% Project. It's a book and also an exhibition documenting the super wealthy around the world and also poverty around the world. Let's talk a little bit more about the photographs. There's one fascinating photograph of a congregation at a church that you say Jesus believes that Jesus wants people to be wealthy and the people there. Can you tell us about that picture?
Mm-hmm. This is by a great documentary photographer named Nina Berman, and it's a church in Atlanta, Georgia, I believe, that preaches the prosperity gospel. Now, what that means is that God wants us to be rich and be prosperous, and the preacher was tremendously successful. He had thousands, if not tens of thousands, of followers and made millions of dollars off of this congregation, many of whom were working class, according to the photographer. And I think it is to me one of the more dispiriting images in the project. It speaks not only about this church, but in my mind, it also speaks about a larger idea that I see in American culture of the celebration of the powerful by the powerless. You know, a cheerleading role that the powerless take on for themselves to promote the better off. And I'm not totally convinced that that millionaire pastor needs our money or our support, frankly. He seems to be doing okay for himself. I think that there's another image in the book which is somewhat related by Juliana Sohn, and it's a beautiful image of a gentleman who is cleaning one of the Hollywood stars, you know, that little bronze plaque in Hollywood. He has no legs, but he's clearly, you know, working very hard to put food on the table. And I respect him for that effort. But again, what is compelling to me about it is the larger metaphor, this idea of the powerless celebrating the powerful.
And you've got a great quote from a billionaire equity investor who said that wealth gaps like the one that we're seeing right now, that they cannot last. What do you think he was getting at?
He says that looking back in history, this kind of inequality is fragile, and that through some way, through war or revolution or simply much higher taxes, you know, things will get equalized. We saw, you know, I think that there's actually a chorus of very wealthy people around the world who are starting to see that this is bad PR. You know, this is not going to help anybody, whether it's the poor, the middle class, or the wealthy, because if you get enough angry people voting in enough elections, you know, that wealth in the upper 1% might very well be challenged sooner or later.
Miles, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Miles Little is the curator of the 1% Project. You can check out some of the photographs and find more information on the Central Time website and on our Facebook page. Coming up, we'll find out why bobcat sightings are up in southern Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, some residents of Brown County are alleging a wind farm is causing health problems in the area. We'll talk to a reporter who's been covering the Shirley Wind Farm and the groups opposed to it. First, bobcat sightings are up in southern Wisconsin. Used to be that bobcats were presumed to be more common in northern parts of the state, but they're being sighted a lot more often in the south lately. WPR's Eau Claire reporter Rich Kramer joins us now to tell us more about that shift. Rich, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So as someone who's lived in southern Wisconsin for most of her life, the bobcat isn't an animal that I usually look for when I'm out hiking. Can you describe them for us?
Sure. They're about twice the size of a house cat, weighing in around 20 pounds, orange, tannish fur with black stripes on the face, spots on the body, stubby bobbed tail, hence the bobcat terminology. And large ears also. A lot of people notice the pointed tufts of fur off the top of the ears. They like to eat, you know, small mammals, rabbits. They'll go after deer if they're young or sick. Porcupines, squirrels, woodchucks, you name it, mice. And their range, turns out, it's much wider than what the DNR was really used to or expecting.
Right. I mean, we normally think of bobcats in northern Wisconsin. It sounds like a lot more people are seeing them in southern Wisconsin now. How do we know that?
Well, I did an interview with Nathan Roberts. He's a fur bearer research scientist. His job is strictly doing the hardcore research on small mammals. And he says that the DNR has been getting a lot more calls about bobcat sightings from people in southern Wisconsin. And in the last couple of years, there has been enough of a response from the citizens that the DNR has approved actual bobcat hunting and trapping. They started with 50 animals in the 2013-2014 winter, and then the next year after that, they went to 100 animals. So they are just getting more reports. It's all verbal reports. There haven't been any hardcore studies of the population down there yet, though.
And in terms of, you know, northern Wisconsin, it's more sparsely populated. There's a lot more in terms of forests and natural areas than in the south. So what do bobcats prefer? Do we know where they tend to be found?
Well, that's what's really interesting. Nathan told me that one of the biggest surprises, the DNR has been studying for 2 years now. They've been doing bobcat population research study in northern Wisconsin. And they typically assumed that the bobcats kind of hung out in really dense forested areas and wetlands, places that are kind of hard to get to for humans. But their population study, they've found that bobcats live in towns. They'll go from bird feeder to bird feeder in people's backyards, picking off birds. They live along row crops, you know, farm fields, places that they never would have expected. Basically, they've told me that bobcats are everywhere.
Now, what you're saying kind of reminds me a little bit about what we hear about coyotes, that they've moved into the urban areas, they're getting acclimated, and sometimes they'll poach, you know, a dog from somebody's backyard. Should we be having kind of similar concerns, at least about pet safety, when it comes to bobcats?
We didn't really go there when I was talking with the DNR, but there haven't been any warnings to people, you know, about safeguarding their pets. I mean, bobcats are still hard to see. They're pretty elusive animals, but I guess they're among us. They're living among us.
Are they more active at night?
Yeah, when they move, most often it's late. It's the twilight period, so early morning and late evening. Also in the winter, that's when they do most of their hunting during the day. So that's when folks are more likely to spot them.
Now, you mentioned that the population has rebounded enough to the point where there is now a hunting season on bobcats. Do we have a kind of a rough estimate about how many bobcats might live in Wisconsin?
Not really, and I want to clarify the hunting season. There's two different zones. So north of Highway 64, we're talking about northern Wisconsin, there is a quota. I think it's at 300 bobcats right now, and that's where they're doing this really interesting population research study. In southern Wisconsin, they just started at a very low number, you know, 50, and then they went to 100 animals. They're going to reassess in May whether or not to increase that, but there haven't been any actual studies to date, in the recent years, I should say, in southern Wisconsin. So they're not really sure of the total population in the state. They're getting a better handle of it on it up north.
We're talking with Rich Kramer right now. He's WPR's Eau Claire reporter. We're talking about news that bobcat sightings are becoming increasingly common in southern Wisconsin. And, Rich, looking at why the bobcats might be returning in greater numbers to the southern part of the state, what do we know?
Not much. The study is just looking at, you know, they're basically collaring bobcats in northern Wisconsin, putting GPS tracking collars on, which makes it a lot easier for the DNR to do this. They told me that prior to this, they had to do the old radio collar, you know, with the antenna, and you're standing on the back of a truck pointing the antenna. It costs a lot of money to track bobcats that way. Now GPS technology has gotten so small that you can put a collar on it, kind of set it and forget it, let the cat do its thing, and it automatically reports its position. So they don't really know why the bobcats disappeared from southern Wisconsin, or at least they thought they disappeared. One of the suggestions was perhaps, you know, it's just a lot of people, a lot more people down there. Also, back prior to 1970, there was a lot of, you know, logging going on. There was a lot of farming, and farmers saw these animals as a big threat to their livestock. So there was no hunting regulations. There was no restrictions on killing these things. So the other thought is that the bobcats might have been over-hunted or just killed beyond sustainable levels. But in the last few years, it seems to be they're coming back. And like I said, there was no hunting for 20 years. There was no hunting allowed of bobcats in southern Wisconsin until, I believe it was actually 2014, 2015, that winter.
And Rich, what are the big questions? And it sounds like there's a lot of them, but what are the big ones that scientists, the DNR, are trying to answer about the bobcat population in Wisconsin?
Well, with the Northern study, they want to know, they want to get a better handle on how many are out there. They want to get a better handle on the age, the range, how they interact with people, how they interact with other bobcats. That's another thing that they found that was really surprising. Bobcats, at least females, don't seem to care about their territories overlapping. You know, a lot of other animals are fiercely territorial. Bobcats don't seem to mind. Even males don't seem to mind all that much. So at this point, they're just trying to get a handle on the population level so they can set a responsible and a good number for harvesting, for hunting and trapping.
And do people have to be wary if they encounter a bobcat in the woods, or are they just so elusive that you're just lucky if you see one?
You're lucky if you see one, and it's probably going to take off once you see it. I was looking on YouTube, and I found a couple videos, and it's really, people are very startled if they find one. One video was very funny. The bobcat was actually, like, under the snow, and they were walking. All of a sudden, this thing leaps out of the snow and takes off. they're not interested at all in people. They just want to stay away. They want to... I mean, think of some house cats. They get spooked when a stranger comes in, so...
Right.
I guess that kind of mindset transfers between different animals.
Different cat species there, yeah.
Right.
Well, so it sounds like the DNR is still looking to get a handle on the numbers and answer some of these basic questions. So if people want to help, should they be reporting bobcat sightings?
Definitely. The DNR, they appreciate it when people call those in. I mean, that's how they started noticing or... Between, I think, the last few years, that's when they've started getting the calls from folks in southern Wisconsin. They've also, the DNR is working with trappers, so they really want to hear from trappers, especially up north, because that's how they're finding these animals to collar. The new traps, I guess, the DNR told me that they've got foothold traps, so a bobcat will get caught in it when they're trying to trap, say, something like a coyote or... maybe a mink or whatever. The bobcat gets caught in there, so then the trapper calls the DNR. DNR rushes out with a GPS collar, and that is how they're able to collar these animals. They told me that in the past, when they had to do all this themselves, they were lucky if they got 8 animals for a study in a year. Now, this last year, they collared 29. Hmm. So they're able to get much more data, much more cheaply. And they don't even have to follow them around with a radio tracker collar.
And, Rich, you're kind of in the Northwoods. My husband and I argue about whether Eau Claire is considered northern Wisconsin or not, but have you seen a bobcat?
I have not. No, I have not seen a bobcat. I haven't seen a cougar either. I've seen coyotes. Don't think I've ever seen a wolf. And I'm from Superior, so I will say when people call Eau Claire northern Wisconsin, I kind of scoff. But no, they're... I have not.
No.
I would love to see one, though. I actually worked with a fellow who was a trapper, and he had a lynx that he had trapped and mounted, and it was a beautiful animal. And lynx are very similar to bobcats, too, but not personally.
Well, Rich, good luck with your bobcat spotting, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was WPR's Eau Claire reporter, Rich Kramer. He joined us to talk about the news that bobcat sightings are up in southern Wisconsin. Coming up, a wind farm in Brown County is causing some headaches, both figuratively and maybe literally. We'll talk with a reporter who's been covering the controversy in just a moment. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll hear about opiate abuse and its effect on the families of those addicted. But first, residents of Brown County are alleging that the Shirley Wind Farm is causing a host of health concerns, ranging from headaches to disrupted sleep, and an email from the previous county health director revealed that she seemed to suffer headaches while visiting that site. While some groups point to the wind turbines as the source of the issues, there isn't a consensus on whether they can be blamed or if something else is at play in Brown County. Joining us now is Doug Schneider. He's the Brown County reporter with the Green Bay Press Gazette and recently wrote about the Shirley Wind Farm and the complaints lodged against it. Doug, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Thank you for inviting me.
So can you give us an overview of what's happening in Brown County with the Shirley Wind Farm?
It's kind of the classic citizens versus corporations, peaceful rural existence versus commerce debate. Folks living around the 8 wind turbines in southern Brown County are saying that the turbines are making them sick. And there's a debate among scientists and among affected people about whether there's enough evidence to say if that's true.
And what are some of the health complaints that people have so far?
There are a range of complaints, sleep disturbances to the extent that some people report only being able to sleep for an hour or two or at night, young children who can't sleep, adults reporting vertigo, things of that nature. But there's a range. And one of the things that's an issue here is that there doesn't seem to be one particular symptom that makes it easy to make a connection.
And there has been resistance to the wind farm, and some organizations have gathered their forces against it. Who are the people who are concerned about the wind farm?
There's a citizens group that's formed. They're called Brown County Citizens for Responsible Wind Energy. They are people who live in the area, some of whom are affected, and some of whom are simply trying to look out for their neighbors. And they also have concerns about property values and the future of their community.
Now, you wrote about a recent email that was made public through an open records request showing that the former Brown County Health Director wrote in an email to an intern that she was exhibiting some symptoms that might have been connected with the site. Can you tell us what that email said and how it was obtained?
The email was obtained by the citizens group that took months for the county to fill. In it, the health director who recently resigned says that the times have been out there by the wind turbines, I get such migraine headaches. I think I should take some preventative Tylenol before I head out there. To the citizens who are fighting the wind farm, they say that's a smoking gun. You know, look, it's true, they make people sick. To others, they say, well, there's indications that she had migraines before. Migraines can be brought on by a lot of things, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just, it's becoming one more thing that there's debate about.
Was she visiting the wind farm to determine whether there was a grounding to these health complaints?
She had been paying repeated visits to the area back last fall in order to do her homework for a report that she issued in December about whether those turbines could be linked to health problems. She eventually issued a ruling that said there was insufficient evidence to connect people's health problems to the presence of the wind turbines.
So this email has been made public, and there are still these groups opposing, trying to voice their concerns with the wind farm. Where do they go from here? What kind of recourse do they have, and what direction do you think they might take it?
Where do we go from here is the $10,000 question. It would seem that it's likely that this will end up in court at some point. You've got the citizens are looking to government for answers. County government at this point has not been able to come up with anything that satisfied the citizens group. Obviously, there's concern about interference with commerce, and the prevailing wisdom seems to be that eventually somebody's going to sue somebody over this, and it's going to get real serious. In the meantime, there's some hope among citizens groups and local government officials that the state could be encouraged to step in and pass stricter regulations of wind turbines and or possibly provide some aid to people who are affected, either in terms of their health or their property values or both.
Are there groups, maybe not limited to the Shirley Wind Farm, that are supportive of having it there and see benefits?
There doesn't appear to be organized support of it, but there are certainly people who see their value. There's value in the jobs that are associated with it. There's value in a source of electricity that's not generated from fossil fuels or other resources that might have effects on the environment and are not as easily renewed as wind. But they don't seem to be as passionate or as organized as the opponents. You know, quite frankly, the things are there. They operate. The negative argument tends to get, in any situation, tends to get greater support.
Now, as I understand it, this is not the only case of there being concerns around wind farms. Do you know about any other action statewide?
I am not very familiar with the bigger wind farm picture in Wisconsin. I know there have been issues other places in the country, and one of the more interesting ones is in a community outside of Boston called Falmouth, Massachusetts, where the municipality actually built the wind farm and had neighbors begin complaining of illnesses. And the municipality actually took the step of shutting down the turbines for 12 out of each 24 hours, I believe it is.
And I'm sorry we have to leave it there, Doug. It's an interesting case. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Doug Schneider is the Brown County reporter with the Green Bay Press Gazette. He joined us to talk about the Shirley Wind Farm and the health complaints that may be tied to it.